Hey, Teresa.
Hello.
Where are you right now?
Seattle, Washington.
Oh, great. So you're right in the middle of the Moderna safety trials.
Are they doing them in Seattle?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we are. We're right in the middle of a lot here in Seattle. We have the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. And maybe they could get some volunteers up there.
Have you been down there?
No. No.
Okay. So, welcome, everybody. I'm talking to Dr. Teresa Deischer, who is the founder, and that's the way to pronounce your name, right? Dr. Deischer?
Deischer, yes.
Okay. And she's the founder and lead scientist at Sound Choice Pharmaceutical Institute. And she has a doctorate from Stanford University in molecular and cellular physiology in 1990 and completed her postdoctoral work at the University of Washington. Her career has been spent in commercial biotechnology industry, and she has done basic work in biological and drug discovery through clinical development. And the Sound Choice Pharmaceutical, which is your organization, that's an advocacy organization that tries to pressure drug companies to improve safety of vaccinations, correct? Am I saying that right?
So Sound Choice Pharmaceutical Institute is actually a biomedical research institute that focuses on research and information about the manufacturing of vaccines and the public health consequences to our vaccine manufacturing practices. We're not an advocacy organization ourselves.
Okay. So would you describe yourself as a science organization or research organization, information organization?
A research and information organization, exactly.
Okay. And your own expertise has been in looking at the impacts of the use of human fetal cells in vaccines.
Correct. And when I was originally made aware of the vaccine manufacturing practices, we were asked, we have a for-profit as well, ABM Biotechnology, and we were asked to bring in alternative vaccines so that people who wanted to vaccinate and who morally or philosophically could not use the human fetal manufactured vaccines, so that they would have an alternative. And in agreeing to take a look at that, I began reading about vaccines. I wasn't a vaccine expert. I've done, you know, antibody and protein manufacturing projects, but not vaccines. If you can't miss the vaccine autism controversy, which as an outsider, you know, I found interesting and began reading the scientific papers about that. And received some phone calls about how the manufacturing could impact human health. And one call was whether a gene that causes autism could come through the manufacturing process, which is impossible. And in replying to that, I did realize, well, you know, there is going to be a lot of human fetal DNA fragments that are going to come through the manufacturing process. And that is potentially very dangerous.
Okay, before we talk about the dangers, and by the way, just so our audience knows, we are not going to be talking about the moral implications of using fetal tissue in vaccines today. We're going to focus on the science, and we're going to focus on what is known, what is provable, and what is not, and what is also reasonably speculative. But tell us first, before we talk about the dangers, Tell us first why anybody would want to put fetal tissue in vaccines. Where is it in the manufacturing process that fetal tissue is used? It is a substrate upon which viruses are grown in the manufacturing.
You are correct. There is not any fetal tissue in the vaccines. They use cell lines that were made from the bodies of electively aborted babies. But if they were to use cell lines from placenta, that's not morally objectionable. The human health consequences would be as of concern, right? So regardless of the source of the fetal cell, the contaminants from the cell line that would be primitive fetal material will be a significant safety concern.
And how do those get in the vaccine?
Well, a vaccine is basically a long string of either RNA or DNA, the virus. It's too long to make economically in a test tube. And so they mimic nature's way of replicating viruses, and they infect cells. And the virus grows in the cells. And then at the end of that process, they try to purify the virus away from the cellular material. But most people understand there's a give and take between purity and amount. And so if they were to purify away all of the fetal cell line contaminants, the yield of the virus would be so low, no one could afford it. And so it's that balance between yield and purity that results in actually very high levels of fetal DNA fragments being left in vaccines.
And now let's talk about the dangers.
So the fetal DNA is what's considered primitive DNA. Viral DNA is primitive, fetal DNA is primitive. And when I say primitive, DNA is not just ATCG. It is decorated, and it's decorated with sugars and methyl groups and other additions like nitrosyl groups that are put onto the DNA that regulate how the DNA is used. And that decoration is entirely species specific. So if a chicken cell is used to make our vaccines, we have chicken DNA fragments in the final product, but those are decorated like a chicken. And so our body will recognize them as foreign and eliminate them. And if they were to get into a human cell, they could not incorporate into the DNA. They just cannot. And they actually don't even get taken up to any extent. But when you have
Let me go back. Let me interrupt you for a second because I want you to finish that thought. But one of the questions people are asking now is which vaccines have fetal tissue in them? And I know that for a long time, fetal cells were not used in vaccines. Almost exclusively animal cells were used. So maybe you can talk about why they started replacing the animal cells with fetal cells and which particular vaccines contain fetal tissue.
So currently the MMR vaccines, the chickenpox vaccine, one of the shingles vaccines, Zostavax, is made in fetal cells. All hepatitis A containing vaccines are made in fetal cells. Some polio containing vaccines and some rabies containing vaccines. And people can go to our website, www.soundchoice.org, and pull down a list of the vaccines. Interestingly, Sanofi just switched the manufacturer of their polio and polio containing vaccines away from human fetal cells to an animal cell.
And I know the Japanese did out of the MMR vaccine too, because the MMR vaccine was causing so many problems Since they put the human fetal tissue in, and I think they switched to rabbit cells.
Well, there are multiple vaccines available in Japan, and there are vaccines, MMR, that are made in rabbit and quail cells. And the Japanese have a different approach to vaccination. You can get the individual vaccines as well. You just want the measles, you just want the mumps, you just want the rubella. And that was made by Kitasato Institute, who is now bought by Daiichi Sankyo. So there are other MMR vaccines that are sold in Japan that are made from MMR. Merck's MMR, that is made in human fetal cells, is also sold in Japan. So depends on which company they get their vaccine from.
Oh, you're saying that if you inject an animal cell, well, look, before we get to that, let me finish the other question. Why did they switch from using exclusively animal cells to fetal cells?
I think it's complicated. The animal rights movement was very active at that time. And for instance, chickenpox could have been manufactured in a guinea pig cell line, but there's quite a bit of objection to using animals for research. And the animal activists were definitely driving them to go and use the bodies of the aborted babies. Economically, they thought that it would be cheaper. It's not, though, because the regulatory aspects are so much higher. And it turns out making the virus costs less than 10 cents. Vialing the virus is the cost. That's $10. So it didn't end up being more economical for them.
It's kind of weird to think that the animal rights activists have more clout the vaccine companies than do the anti-abortion activists.
They do. And you know what's really alarming is that lack of outcry over human babies born alive at 5 to 6 months old so that their hearts can be attained beating, and they have to be beating to be used in the research that's being done. The heart is stopped beating, it's not useful, you cannot use it. And so these babies are delivered alive and their hearts cut out without anesthesia. I wouldn't do that to a mouse.
You mean, when you say 5 months old, you're talking about a fetus that is 5 months old?
Yes.
And they are live birthed?
Yes.
And they are surgically killed?
Their hearts are cut out, or they cut through their faces to get good brain tissue.
Okay, that is horrible.
It is, and we wouldn't do that to a mouse.
So, we have deposed Stanley Plotkin, and Stanley Plotkin described making, I think he used about 75 fetuses at some point to make the many vaccines that he was involved in. And he said that they used the entire fetus, that the fetuses were aborted, and that they were cut into parts, that they used the tongues, they used the eyes, they used all the parts of the fetus. Oh, is that true, or do they just use the heart and the brain?
Well, they use the baby, and certain scientists will purchase the heart, and another scientist would purchase the brain, and they purchase the legs or the eyes. Yeah, the body parts are sold for research. I got a catalog 20 plus years ago. I'll never forget the prices. 32-week-old baby, that's a living baby. I mean, or early deliveries survive at 21 weeks now. I mean, so we're talking about viable babies. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it's hard not to start talking about this is so morally revolting that it is difficult not to talk about the moral implications of this, but I know your expertise on the science, so let's go back and talk about the science. And, you know, I'm going to try to get over what I just heard. But you were, when I interrupted you earlier, you were saying that the animal tissue is actually safer. I think they switched to human tissue because they thought also that it might be safer, but because a lot of the animal tissues contain retroviruses that were then showing up in the human blood supply in the human genome, like the XMRV virus, which caused leukemia, that they didn't know about, that it was in mouse brains, and then a lot of the monkey viruses, like SV40, which was in all the polio vaccines, which also is a very potent carcinogen. And they weren't able to detect those animal viruses, retroviruses, prior to the vaccine being made. I think one of the justifications for switching to human tissue was that you were less likely to get retroviruses. Do you want to stop me there and comment on that, or should we go on?
No, I agree with you. I think that from that, as I said, it was a complicated issue. You know, as you read the documents, when they talk about the switch, they were not knowledgeable. They didn't know that there were retroviruses in the animal cell lines at that time. And so that knowledge came later with better detection techniques. But I think that they, you know, without having the information we have now, so, you know, with the information they had at the time, they thought they were doing the best thing, and they debated it for 50 years before they allowed it. But we've learned so much from gene therapy and immunology that it's time to take another look.
Oh, now let's get back to what we were talking about. What you said was the animal, when you use animal tissue, the animal DNA is recognized as a foreign substance by your body.
Correct.
And you reject it and excrete it.
Correct.
When they started using fetal tissue, the fetal tissue is not recognized as foreign. So what are the implications of that?
So in a certain number of people, it won't be recognized as foreign because it's primitive, and it has fewer methyl groups on it than a normal person would have or an adult. So for example, human fetal DNA enters your body, and you are going to most likely mount an immune response to it when it's seen, because it's not self, right? But it's fetal DNA, it's primitive. And so in people who have a genetic predisposition to have lower methylation of their DNA, hypomethylated DNA, like if they have an MHTFR mutation, they will mount a response likely to the human fetal DNA, but the antibodies are gonna be for hypomethylated DNA, and that person has hypomethylated DNA, and so they would have a high chance of having a self attack because of the antibodies that they make to the primitive fetal DNA. Does that make sense? If a person, a child, even an adult, has a genetic predisposition so that their own DNA is a more primitive kind of DNA, it has hypomethylated status, then antibodies to the fetal DNA could turn around and attack the person's own body.
Yeah, and hypomethylated means it doesn't have, hypo means less.
Yes.
Oh, it means it has less of a methylation capacity. And the methylation capacity is the capacity to process sugars and proteins and Describe what that is, why that's important to methylate.
So the methylations control how genes are used, right? So in a fetal state, you're using lots of your genes, right? But when you get to an adult state, you don't want to use all of the genes that you use during development, right? Because you're not going through development anymore. You're a born organism. You're going to want to turn on other genes. And so the fetal genes after birth get more methyl groups put on them so they're not used. And what happens if you lose those methyl groups later, oftentimes you can get cancer. Or you could get an autoimmune disease.
And so that the audience knows, people who have the MTFR gene are people who appear to be much more susceptible to vaccine injury than other people. Now, one of the things that the industry will say is that not enough of this DNA gets into the vaccinated individual to make any difference. Can you explain why that's not true?
Yeah, well, anyone who says that doesn't know anything about immunology or virology, or they would never make such a statement. And I don't think most people even know how that viruses and vaccines work. But let's look at a good baby topic, having a baby. So delivery. So as the pregnancy goes on, the placenta breaks down. And what happens is that fetal DNA fragments from the baby end up in the mother's circulation. And when they reach a certain level, they trigger an immune receptor. It's called Toll-like receptor 9. That's the same receptor that viruses and DNA vaccines trigger. But the fetal—
And it's actually an autoimmunist response. You're attacking—
It is.
You're notifying your body that the placenta, you've suddenly discovered, oh, that placenta is a foreign invader and I need to get rid of it. And that's what caused the woman to go into labor.
Exactly. And so antibodies are made, and then they see the baby, right, the placenta, and they attack, and that triggers labor, right? That's a massive autoimmune rejection, right? Or immune rejection, right? That's how you get your baby. And that's a good outcome. When we inject infants and young children with the amount of fetal DNA in the vaccines, they have levels in their blood, concentrations higher than the levels that trigger labor. So you can't tell me that that is not going to cause an immune response. Absolutely, it's going to cause an immune response. And anyone who says different does not know what they're talking about, or they're not telling the truth.
And so what you're saying is that you're putting enough DNA into that baby that that same level, less levels of DNA, of foreign DNA, cause a woman to mount an autoimmune response against the placenta and excrete it. And so an even greater level that occurs in vaccinated individual might be causing actual autoimmunity in those children.
It's going to elicit an immune response, absolutely. And the presence of that immune response, if the person is genetically susceptible to having under-methylated, low-methyl DNA, then they're a danger that they could have a later autoimmune response. It could be within days. It could be months down the line. There would have to be exposure of that person's own DNA. And if that was exposed, then you've got antibodies that are going to recognize it as foreign and attack that person's own organs. It could be 20 years later. I mean, there's no time frame. As long as those antibodies remain in the body, and antibodies will be around for 10, 20, maybe even up to 30 years, that person, if they have their own DNA exposed, could end up with an autoimmune disease.
And when, you know, when they ask Paul Offit about this, he says, you're putting the amounts that you're putting in these vaccines is so small that it can have no impact on the human body, but actually that vaccine is intended to permanently alter the immune system of that child. I mean, that's how they advertise it. That's how they sell it. And there's actually a difference. But there's kind of a signature with autistic kids where they have those particular DNA strands or antibodies that you're taught, that antibody reaction to the DNA can be found in kids with autism and not in other kids. It's a signature, correct? Explain that.
There are scientific publications that about 35% to 40% of children with autism have an immune response to, it means that they had to have been exposed to human DNA at some point that triggered them to mount a response, whereas typically developing children don't have those antibodies.
And actually, the timing of when they started putting fetal DNA into the MMR vaccine was also perfectly correlates with the first change points for the escalation of the climb of autism rates in American children. Isn't that correct?
It does. About 1979, 1980. Yeah.
And so before that, there was chicken DNA?
Chicken or quail, yeah.
Okay. And let's talk about cancer. Could the DNA, first of all, are any of the DNAs that they're using in vaccines, have any of those been immortalized?
Well, some of the human cell lines have been immortalized, but others are just as sort of assumed immortal. And
by, just so that people know, by immortal, we mean they're tumorigenic, really, right? They've been essentially rendered cancerous so that they will never die. So they continue breeding and living, which makes it easier to grow cultures on them.
Well, this
am I simplifying that, or
so? One has been transformed with Epstein-Barr virus. That's immortal. It's called the HEK293 in their cell lines, but the lines used in vaccine manufacturing are largely not immortal, and they're reaching the end of their lifespan. So, like 35 years of manufacturing, and so people are making new fetal lines to replace them.
And what is it? Well, let's talk about cancer. I want to go back to Epstein-Barr because I'm very curious about that. I mean, they actually put used Epstein-Barr virus to manufacture vaccines?
No, they used a portion of the Epstein-Barr virus to make the HEK293 cell immortal.
Is it possible that the Epstein-Barr virus could have gotten into the vaccines?
The HEK293 cell line isn't used to make the vaccines. The MRC, it's a line called MRC5 and one called WI38 that are predominantly used.
And those were from babies who were aborted like in the 70s and the 80s?
Yeah, back in the late 60s and 70s, that is correct.
Okay, let's go back to talk about cancer. Could these vaccines be causing cancer in children?
So the other danger of having the primitive, low methylated human DNA fragments we know about from the field of gene therapy. So trying to do gene therapy to treat, you know, horrible diseases, they started by trying to replace like entire genes. But that's too long. The gene's too big to get it to go in and insert and incorporate into the DNA efficiently. And so what scientists did was they started using small fragments of DNA to correct gene mutations. And they correct the mutations in stem cells, and then they give the stem cells back to the person with the gene mutation. And it turns out that if you give the DNA fragments to the body, like in we call it in vivo, if you inject them into a vein, stem cells love to take them up if they're from a primitive source, like a fetus or a placenta or a sperm. If they're from an adult, they don't get taken up. And what happens is they readily insert into the genome of the stem cells that take them up. So if you do mouse experiments, 100% of the mice will take up those DNA fragments. And anytime you have an insertion, that's a mutation. And it turns out, from what the gene therapy field learned, I don't know why this is, but this is just what happens. Those primitive DNA fragments like to insert in areas of the genome where they give that cell a survival advantage or a proliferation advantage. And our blood cell formation is a phenomenal biology. We have trillions of blood cells in our body, and 8 parent stem cells typically make all of the other stem cells that give rise to all of those, you know, working trillions of blood cells, right? So you mutate a stem cell, it gets a survival advantage, and it's situations where we have 8 blood cells, most of us, 8 stem cells making all our blood cells, that's called oligoclonal blood formation. And we have diseases where you have monoclonal, one cell takes over that aren't cancer. It happens in some forms of heart disease, right? But if you have a mutation in that one stem cell, and because you've had an insertion, you're at high risk to have another mutation and that becomes cancerous. That's very dangerous. And we know from gene therapy trials that happened, and 4 of 9 boys got cancer. The scientists like Dr. Prophet, or no, Offit, oops, I'm sorry. Offit and Plotkin, I'm so sorry. Like Dr. Offit and Dr. Plotkin, those kinds of people estimated that the risk was like 1 to the -13. It means we would have to treat more children than exist before we'd ever see harm. The data, the real data said 4 of 9. They were way off. And so I wouldn't listen to anything they say about safety.
Yeah, and so what you're saying is that the DNA preferentially invades and kind of assists the cells that might be leukemia cells or cancer cells, because they have an advantage of proliferation. They're more likely to spread and to live and survive. They know which cells are immortal, and it goes into those cells, and then that cell is going to basically cause cancer.
Right. So from the gene therapy experts have published stacks of papers on this. The fragments are readily taken up by blood stem cells where they insert, and they'll give that blood stem cell a proliferation or survival advantage so that it could take over and become the dominant stem cell making most of our blood cells. And whenever you have an insertion, that's a mutation in and of itself, but what commonly happens is it causes other mutations to occur because it messes up how the DNA is read. So insertions cause mutations as well.
Oh, and if it causes cancer, is the cancer likely to show up immediately, or could it show up 10 years later? For what?
No, it doesn't have to show up immediately. It could show up years later. And we know from the gene therapy trials that in some of these young boys who basically got the contaminants of the vaccines, what's in there, human primitive DNA fragments, and there was a retrovirus in there too. So I am concerned about retroviruses. Yeah, it took a couple years in some of them. Some was weeks, some was a couple years.
What, by the way, what is the HERVK? Is that a retrovirus?
Human endogenous retrovirus K, yeah.
And is that what you were just talking about when you said there was a retrovirus in there?
Well, in the vaccines, the MMR and the chicken parts are contaminated with the HERVK virus. And that virus is associated with autoimmune diseases. There are many publications on that. It's known to be able to reactivate. It's a very controversial topic. More and more is being published on it. But that virus does contaminate, fragments of the virus contaminates the chickenpox vaccine and Merck's MMR vaccine.
And where did it come from?
WI-38, the cell line that's used to either make the vaccine, or the virus was grown on it for a while and picked up the retrovirus.
And so now is it in all the vaccines that have that particular cell line?
I haven't seen all of them tested. A Canadian group, Victoria is the last name of the first author, published that data in 2010. So I haven't seen testing on results.
And when you say it's controversial, what is the other side saying, that HERVK is not a problem?
Well, they say that it can't recombine and reactivate. I mean, there's good evidence that it has. So, you know, experts say a lot of things, and they think about them empirically, but it doesn't matter what an expert says. You have to go do the test. So even though they say it can't recombine, the data says it has. And now it's the job of scientists to go and figure out how, not to say, oh, no, that can't be possible. Well, the data says it happened. So if it happened, it's possible, right?
When you look at autism, do you see an autoimmune disease?
I do. There's good evidence that a significant number of children have a, you know, general brain inflammatory abnormality, and could certainly be driven by autoimmunity.
Let me ask you this, and this is kind of controversial too, but if this may be sound crazy too, but if you inject a boy's DNA into a girl or a girl's DNA into a boy, could it have any effect on sexuality? Is that likely or unlikely, or?
I don't know, because you're not going to get a full gene injected. You know, I do know that if you look at people with, they call it gender dysphoria, 84% of those people are on the autism spectrum. And so maybe it's more due to, you know, that generalized autoimmune disease or something.
I suppose that it's an area that people worry about, is if you take a little baby and give them one of these live virus vaccines that has genetic material from another human being in it, what could happen? And, you know, my understanding is that one of the vaccines, maybe it was the polio vaccine, was grown on DNA from a fetus of a woman who was in 1966, who was forcibly aborted during when she was committed to a mental hospital for life. And the idea is, if the disease that put her in the mental hospital was a genetic disease, could some of that be passed down? And you're giving this population wide to the entire, baby population. Could it affect, could it affect some other area that would be unexpected like that?
I wouldn't expect it because an entire gene is not going to come through. It's not impossible.
Have you been following the COVID vaccines at all?
We have very closely. So,
and how many of those
therapeutic for COVID-19?
How many of those contain fetal tissue?
You know what? Gina has a list that she's published. I haven't really followed that too much for several reasons. Coronaviruses are not viruses that are going to be easily vaccinated against. And, there hasn't been a successful vaccine made against a coronavirus yet. And so this virus has mutated, fairly significantly. And it's also become, the disease has become less severe. That's a natural lifespan of a virus. We think it may kind of become like seasonal influenza, where it's going to reemerge seasonally. Even if a vaccine were to be made that's safe and effective, the most effective influenza A vaccine is only 45%. So 65% of the people won't. But we're focused on a treatment for those who become severely ill. And in our for-profit company, ABM Biotechnology, we have a small molecule that mobilizes a person's own supercharged immune cells. And we're moving that forward to treat those patients who become severely ill, because those immune cells are programmed to kill viruses. So our focus has not been on vaccines or antivirals, but actually treating those patients who can't be protected or who can't be treated with the other, things that are available.
I think the Oxford vaccine was grown on fetal tissue. Of course, the mRNA vaccines like the Moderna would not be. What's your feeling about the risks of mRNA vaccine? I'm gonna close with this discussion, but I'm very, very interested in your opinion, being somebody who knows a lot about DNA expression. People have said it alters the DNA, but other people says no, it doesn't do that. So give us your wisdom on the mRNA vaccines.
So I've had two board members join ABM Biotechnology in the last 2 months who are international respiratory disease and vaccine experts. Dr. Manon Cox, who was at Protein Science, where she made and got approved the most effective influenza vaccine, which is called Flublok, and it's about 45% effective. It has no adjuvants in the vaccine, and it's made in insect cells. So retroviruses are not really a concern.
Insect cells are a good thing. That's what we should hope for.
Yeah.
Because most people, when they hear the vaccine was made on insect cells, say, I don't want cockroaches in my blood system. But what you're telling me now, which is great to hear, is
actually you'll never grow a fly's wing or something, ridiculous like that, right? People are worried about that kind of stuff, but it's just not going to happen. So. But there's no adjuvants, and it's made either to one protein, or a couple of the proteins based on the strains. And so you don't actually have to get the illness, right? Whereas, if you have a full-length flu virus, you can get mild illness, and people get even severe illness. So I like the protein, the DNA-based vaccines without adjuvants.
Is this what they call the spike protein vaccines?
Well, the spike protein vaccines, yeah. And we're concerned that it depends on if they use the full length spike protein or just a portion, but the people getting COVID-19 disease are not making antibodies to the spike protein unless they have severe disease. So I don't know that the spike protein is going to work in this case. I don't know that vaccines are going to be able to be made that work.
Okay, but back to the mRNA vaccine. What do you worry about that? What's your worry about mRNA vaccines? Are you saying that's a better choice or not?
I think the mRNA vaccines are definitely a better choice than any sort of full-length viral vaccine, absolutely. I don't know how they would compare to the DNA vaccines. They're new. We're going to have to see, right? But they're rushing these vaccines forward. How are they going to get safety testing? And they're proposing human challenge studies. That is so unethical that people would actually volunteer to be injected with live coronavirus to see if the vaccine works. I don't know that there's such a panic and a rush. I think we need treatments like we're developing to treat those most severe while they take a couple years and make a safe and effective vaccine.
Do you think there's a bias in NIH towards having patentable vaccines as opposed to therapeutic drugs?
Having backed vaccines?
Finding a patentable vaccine rather than looking at therapeutic solutions of the kind that you're talking about.
I think they are looking at everything. And the thing that's attractive at vaccines, and it can get people to kind of put blinders on, is that it is a cost-effective way to protect the world. So like in Pakistan, where the coronavirus infections are starting to come up, they can't afford remdesivir. That's beyond their means. And so that's the attractiveness to vaccines. It is something that you can afford to give to everyone. And sometimes it might seem like they have blinders on, right? Because vaccines it's unlikely we're going to have an effective vaccine, okay? So in 45% effectiveness, actually most vaccine experts, you'd use it, but they don't consider that effective, right? Effective is going to be 80%, 90%. It's a cost-effective way to try to protect the world. So that's why people like it.
Let me close with a thought, because you mentioned the flu vaccine, and the Cochrane collaboration actually looked at the flu vaccine. And what they say, CDC used this number that's 47% effective. But it's kind of a deceiving number, because people think, well, that means out of every 100 people, 47 will not get the flu. But actually, very few people actually get the flu, maybe 5%. And Cochrane collaboration said they have to give 100 flu shots to avert one case of the flu. That's what the peer review, they did a massive meta review in 2010, 2014. The British Medical Journal, the editor, Peter Doshi, came back and said the same thing. He said, the flu shots are very, very ineffective, between 73 shots to avert one to 100 shots to avert one case. And there's no evidence that any hospitalizations or deaths are being prevented. In other words, the case of flu that you're preventing is in a teenage kid who wouldn't have died anyway. He's just not going to get the symptoms. And that really doesn't justify giving all those vaccines out to prevent symptoms in, some teenagers. If you're not preventing the symptoms in the people who have comorbidities, people who are fragile elderly, people who are likely to die of the flu. And I think that's going to be one of the big questions with the COVID vaccine. They're testing it on these very kind of elite groups who do not look like the American people. They don't have comorbidities. They don't. 54% of Americans have chronic disease. Nobody in the test group has diabetes. None of them are smokers. None of them are vaping. None of them are drinking. None of them have asthma or rheumatoid arthritis. None of them are fragile elderly. And even if you can prove that it's safe in those groups, which so far we haven't seen, or that it's effective, you're not proving that you're actually averting deaths with it. And what I worry about is they'll test it on those groups, they'll say it's safe and effective, and then they'll give it to everybody, and it may have very, very different effects in fragile elderly. It may even do pathogenic priming and make them more likely to die, and we'll never notice that because our surveillance systems are so messed up. Once the vaccine is in circulation, you do not see any problems with it. They're designed, the surveillance system is designed to fail.
Yeah, I agree. And so, you know, prior to flu block, you know, when they talk about efficacy, effectiveness and efficacy, they're two different things. And so one measure is, do you make antibodies? But making antibodies doesn't say anything about, do you block the disease? And so in many years, the vaccines were 13% or whatever. And since not everyone gets the flu, you'd have to inoculate a lot more people. And there's a lot of other stuff in those vaccines. So I agree. I think when we get up to the numbers where it's, you know, 45 to 50% efficacious, that means they make antibodies that block the influenza, that the, you know, the scales tip a little bit, but you're also right. They're not really preventing deaths. And that's where we're focused. We're focused on a treatment for those people who are gonna get severely ill, whether there's a vaccine or antivirals, they're not being helped. And so we focus on those people, both for influenza as well as for the coronavirus.
Dr. Teresa Deischer, thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell people here what your website is, or how they can support you, or how they can contact you if you want that? Or anyway, I know there's I see a tremendous amount of comments on here of people who want to hear more from you and people who love what you said. So can you tell us how we can support and learn more?
Absolutely. Sound Choice Pharmaceutical Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and our website is soundchoice.org, and we are solely supported by our donations and grant applications when we get them and write them, but we rely on our donors. So if people want to support us, we'd love to have your support. God bless you, and thank you for everything that you do, hope to reconnect soon.
Thank you so much, Dr. Deischer.